independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
All right, looking at the Texans coaching situation, why hiring a Patriots guy is the right choice. I want to go back to Randy Mueller, general manager in the NFL that we had on yesterday, full interview at ESPN975.com. Talked about the benefits of hiring a guy you already have a relationship with.
It does help with the learning curve, and it shortens it, that's for sure, because you can hit the ground running with a partner who you know well. He knows kind of where you're headed. And the systems that they shared in New England are probably going to be the same systems they share there. So there's some advantages to it for sure. Is that the end all? No, I don't think you have to have a relationship, but I found that it allowed us to hit the ground running and really be on the same page from day one.
Hit the ground running, being on the same page from day one. Randy Mueller on hiring a head coach that knows you, having that relationship is vital. I would say that it increases tenfold whenever you have the Patriots way of doing business. And even though Cal McNair said when he hired Nick Caserio that we're not doing it the Patriots way, that was just pandering to the audience. That was pandering to the city of Houston, who got sick of doing it the Patriots way. Yet when you listen to Nick Caserio, he says that's a great organization to model yourself after because they've won a bunch of Super Bowls, which I don't necessarily disagree with. But, and this is something we've talked about looking at this coaching search as well, that you have to have that inner circle guy that already is going to know how the operation's going to be run. And I know that headset gate has been something that's been talked about to nauseam, but any decent candidate outside of this Patriot circle is going to see the headset thing as a general manager who is in your ear on game days, that then the same year that he was in your ear on game days, he fired that coach at the end of the season. That's the other caveat that nobody has been talking about with the headsets. Like, it's not a big deal he's on the headsets. He's going to help you optimize the game. He's just telling you the down and distance. He's just helping out with the analytical side of the stuff. Sure, that can be true. But what else can be true is you can have Doug Peterson saying that dude was on the headset with the head coach, and then he fired that dude 1 year into a five-year contract. So, like, anybody outside of the circle is going to look at that and say, I am out. So that diminishes the quality of candidate you can get that's not inside the Patriots circle.
I mean, look, we talked about whether you call it a puppet or a bridge coach or whatever you're looking for. And then when you hear Nick talk about it, it's all about Nick, and it's going to be he's going to make the decisions. He's running everything. Then he's going to want it a certain way. And so the one thing to Randy's comment is that we talked about yesterday when it caught my ear is the fact that, look, you know it's going to be a Patriots guy because there has to be a pre-existing relationship and a level of communication. But then you ask yourself, is that what you really want? Is someone that just knows how to do it his way or the highway? Because now you're getting back to what we talked about with Bill O'Brien. You need someone that's going to not only ask the question during the interview process, but say, hey, look, I didn't come from the Patriots way. But you know where I came from? I came from a way in the case of Doug Peterson that I won a Super Bowl. And you know how I did that? I did that with a correlation between the way I practiced, my coaching staff that I put together, the way we talked about things, and the way I worked on a daily basis with my front office. But it didn't include the way you interacted with me and that coaching staff that I hired and the way we do things on game day, on the headsets during games. If you want to be on the headset and you want to play a key role in down and distance or analytics and we're trying to make a decision on going for it on a fourth down or something like that, that's fine. That's one thing I'm here to listen to. But if you want a coach that's going to allow you to keep doing what you did with David Culley that is completely unheard of around the league, I'm not here to sign up for that.
And to me, it's the caliber of candidate. Like, can you hire somebody outside of the Patriots circle that would be willing to do this? Yes. But you drop down to, like, the fifth tier, right? Because that first tier, second tier, third tier, if you're outside of the Patriots circle, they're not going to be interested in doing this. So that means you're getting a far lesser candidate outside of the Patriots circle. Whereas if you hire inside the Patriots circle, and there's some unknowns there, Josh McDaniels had this two-year stint in Denver where he had success early, although there are heavy rumors that he was cheating and his video guy got fired. You look at, you know, Brian Flores, who, you know, we've argued about the level of success that he had in Miami, but he has done it and has shown that he's capable at the very least of being a head coach in the NFL. The Jerod Mayo is a name that's been surfacing who we flat out just don't know what he's going to be. He's been a coach for 3 years under Bill Belichick in New England, but is somebody that everybody raves about his leadership, and he's drawing a ton of interest around the NFL. So, like, the best chance you have of getting a better coach is somebody who already knows the way. Because the top-tier coaches outside of the Patriot circle, they're going to look elsewhere because of the red flags, even if they're not that big a deal. Even if we're blowing the red flags out of proportion. People are going to see that and be like, nah, I'm out. But you can get that top tier from the Patriots circle. And that's, to me, why you have to go with a Patriots guy, because you can find that upper echelon coach inside the circle, but you're not finding the upper echelon coach outside of the circle.
Yeah, I just think that, look, sunshine and rainbows, the ideal situation. Everybody's going to think you're going to get the best candidate available. And you're just going to look at Byron Leftwich. You're going to look at Doug Peterson. You're going to look at every single coach and go, I am not going to think Patriots way. I'm thinking that... The best case scenario is I want the best possible candidate, whether that's an up-and-coming coordinator or whether that's an established head coach. But the reality of it is, if Nick knows that this is all on him, he's going to go with what he knows best, which is the Patriots way. When he's looking for a guy that at least is open to the idea of him being on the headset, because they did that with the Patriots, it's going to be a guy that knows the Patriots way. I think the other thing that's key that we talked about yesterday when Randy made the comment was, the one thing you can least afford to do is take a step back. And if you hire someone that wasn't from the Patriots way with the same kind of communication levels, open to the same kind of things, you actually have to reset and start over again, which sets you back before you can go forward as with continuity as a general manager and a head coach. They can't afford to do that because of the fact that they're already deep digging out of a hole. So I think that that's just another reason why it's going to be a Patriots way person.
Now, Casario's talked about, you know, whenever he has talked to some of the coaches around the league, they've asked him about the headset. So we've already been given indication by Nick Casario himself that it is a topic of conversation that he is asked about during these interviews. And I'm not really looking at it from the Texans' point of view whenever you're looking at it from like a hiring standpoint. Like, I'm looking at it from the candidate point of view. Like, if you're Byron Leftwich, who's going to be a hot name in this coaching cycle, if you're a Doug Peterson, who's going to be a hot name in this coaching cycle, I'm looking at it from their point of view and their perspective. Maybe not Brian Flores, because he is inside that circle. But if I'm Byron Leftwich and I'm interviewing with the Texans and I'm interviewing with the Broncos and I'm interviewing with the Bears and I'm interviewing with the Giants, if I'm Doug Peterson and I'm interviewing with all of these teams as well, like, we've already talked about with the Texans situation, with where they're at with their roster, the 53-man roster, the fact that they, if you look at the 53-man roster, they probably have the worst roster in the entire NFL. Yes, they have some assets coming up with the number 3 pick in the NFL draft. Yes, they have the Deshaun Watson return, whatever the return is from the trade. But if you're one of those hotshot candidates, especially if you're outside of the circle, the Texans are going to be dead last on your list. Like, we haven't even seen the Texans sniff around on Doug Peterson. We haven't even seen the Texans sniff around on a Byron Leftwich.
No, they won't either. I mean, they might. Look, I tell you this because I start by saying every time the Texans care what other people think. They care about what the NFL types and the media types think. They care about what the media and the fans think. And so, therefore, because there's no limit on how many guys you can interview, it actually costs you nothing but dinner and a plane ticket. To get as many guys in here as you possibly can. And the other thing that's very interesting, which is something that came up in the people that we interviewed in the last couple of days said too, you may not be not interviewing everybody as a head coaching candidate. They may think they're interviewing for the head coaching candidacy, but what they're really doing is giving you some intel to think about and possibly implement into your system going forward. Like, someone may have some innovative idea. Someone might say, this worked for me when I was working in this situation with this team with the front office and the coaching staff. Things that make a difference so that you get better. Not every candidate is going to be someone you're literally considering for the head coaching job. Some might be for a position coach. Some might be because you're looking for intel and or ways to get better. But it doesn't matter. There's no limit. So interview as many candidates as you want. But realistically, in my opinion, when it comes down to your finalists, they're all going to be paid. And let me also throw this out there. They may, just to appease the media one more time, one of their finalists might not be a Patriots way person, but at the end of the day, the person that they select will be a Patriots way.
Eric the Dog Walker saying, can we please just hire the best guys?
God, I love
Tom Brady,
Eric,
and Bill Belichick are the only successful
Texans.
Patriot way guys. The part is, though, it takes two to tango. Like, it's very easy to say Casario should hire Peterson, but would Peterson be willing to coach the Houston Texans? That's the other side of that argument. And Aggie Mattson, I think coaches would rather lead a team with micromanagement than stay an assistant coach. Money changes minds quickly. And while that is true, it's not going to change the mind of the top-tier coaches that are outside of that Patriot circle whenever they have the other options where the money's going to be about the same. So you're looking automatically, just by default, outside of the Patriot circle, third to fourth tier coaches. Inside the Patriot circle, if you hit, you're hoping they could be first tier head coaches. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Is hiring a Patriots guy the right choice? Also, when we return, Mel Kiper released his first NFL mock draft. Who did he have the Texans taking? We discuss it next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Talking sports with you, not at you. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
8755 says that he's falling in love with Jerod Mayo. Really seems intriguing to me. Everyone that has ever spoken about him says nothing but great things about him.
Know enough about him to fall in love with him.
I mean, you can do a little prep and figure out that he's a great leader, but you don't
Jeremy
know.
Has.
You don't know
there's
he's a
prep,
coach.
And then there's the freaking rabbit holes that you go down.
Well, I mean, I did a little prep.
A little bit
prep. You don't know if he's going to be a good head coach. I agree with that. I mean, it's a risk. It's a volatile decision. It can be a really high. It can be a very low. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Have you seen this phenomenon that's been just going all over the internet known as Wordle?
No. Well, yeah. Yes. You know what? I can't say no.
You sound so disgusted. Like, it is. It's annoying. I'm above even knowing what that is.
I'm not above anything, as people know. What I was mesmerized by, Tyler just starts tweeting out these things. And I go, is this some new fad game that's going on or something like that? And he's like, yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's intense. And I'm like, okay. Is this like, what is this, like Wheel of Fortune on steroids? Kinda.
Yeah, it is kinda.
Joel, if you're disgusted at all about any parts of this, and understandably so,
yeah.
It's slowly progressed in the office, I think, the last week or so.
I've been doing it for 4 days now.
I listened to Jeremy ask like 12 people today if they play Wordle and how it went for them.
Yeah.
Like 2 days ago, it was an experiment for him, and now this guy is fully invested.
Yeah, day one, I got it on 2 guesses. Day two, I got it on 2 guesses. Day three, I got it on 4 guesses, and today I got it on 4 guesses as well. You just have to, it's not an app or anything, you just Google Wordle into the internet, into Google, and you click on the first link, and you just do this Wheel of Fortune, kind of like a hangman type of game. And it's fun. Like, you only have one a day, so it's not something you can really lose sight on. Now, here's why I draw the line, though. Like, if you're posting this on Twitter, you're crossing the line. Like, it's nice to do it with your friends, or maybe your wife plays too, and you're trying to have, like, this little competition. But if you're posting it on Twitter, you're going too far.
You're bragging about it on the radio, so I don't know if you are really the moral high ground
very,
here.
Very fact. Thank you very much for that one, because I was going to say, otherwise you're just taking a blatant shot at Tyler, who lives for tweeting what he did.
I told Tyler to his face that, you know, doing it, showing your results on Twitter is going too far, and he even admitted saying that he was going too far, and that's why he stopped doing it. So, yeah. I mean, I'd be curious to see if you guys are any good at it. See if you can get it on 2 guesses back-to-back days by never playing the game before.
Be careful what you wish for, little fella.
Let's go. Bring it.
Based on the fact that in my house growing up, it was game show, game show, game show. And my mom was nails on Jeopardy and Password and Wheel of Fortune. And I had some good training, so.
All right, we'll bring it. We'll see. It can be a show competition. See who does best every single
day. I don't want to play that stupid game. It seems like it's mind-numbingly time.
He's backing off real quick.
Time-consuming. No, I'm not backing off. See how quick he's backing down? Especially with you, no.
See how quick he's backing down? He's backing down a little bit. Yeah, bring it. Bring it. Bring on the competition. Texans are interested in a new head coach, so I'm going to be doing a deep dive tonight. But the quick glance, Kevin O'Connell, the offensive coordinator for the L.A. Rams. I'm interested what Brendan has to think about this, because Brendan has been watching the L.A. Rams all season long because of one Matthew Stafford. He's also been down on Sean McVay, which is a hot take. Brendan's saying Sean McVay is not a very good head coach. What do you think about the offensive coordinator from the L.A. Rams, Kevin O'Connell?
So first things first, I need to like clarify on Sean McVay. I think as a decision maker, he's awful. I think he is unbelievably conservative for the offensive mastermind.
You're talking about like game management
stuff? Yes. Now, I do think he's an offensive
mastermind.
Better or worse
than his guy Brendan Staley?
I mean, I think he might be the number one. Number two. Shanahan, I think, is the best offensive mind in football. Yeah. I think McVay might be number two.
But I'm saying in terms of decision-making, Staley might be the worst in all of football.
I don't know. There's a lot of bad decision-makers out there.
I think for it on 7 fourth downs, including on his own 17.
There's a lot of bad decision-makers in football. That's all I'll say.
The analytics would say that you should do that, though.
Cully's out of the league. You can't count him.
But to your question, I think just generally speaking, it's dumb to go out and hire the coordinator on the side of the ball of a mastermind.
I would agree.
I don't want to hire a defensive coordinator from the Patriots. I've seen it happen. It doesn't go well.
Yes, you have.
I don't want to hire an offensive coordinator under Shanahan or McVay, ever.
He's not the guy calling the plays, right? So, like, if you need coordinator. But this is another example of what Caserio's looking for in a coach. He's not necessarily looking for a coordinator because this dude's not calling the plays. He's offensive coordinator by title alone.
Stay there for a minute, okay? Because that is it's a very, very valid point. And it's something when you look at it over the it's also like, I don't want to say it's not the hypocrisy of it. It's the mind-numbing, like, inability of teams to see through some of this stuff, right? So, like, Nathaniel Hackett is one of the top names this go-round with head coaching.
Yeah.
He's the offensive coordinator for the Green Bay Packers.
Yep.
He doesn't call the plays, and I hate to break it to you, he's not second in line either. It's Rodgers and LaFleur and then Hackett, but somehow he and the quarterback coach of the Packers are getting all these interviews to be a head coach. It makes no sense because I'm totally with what Brendan said there in the fact that if you are going to hire a coach with that kind of resume and pedigree and that kind of ingenious mind, the last thing you are worried about or need to do is double down on something with your offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator.
It's the case of Eric Bieniemy. Like, you don't hire the coach that's not responsible for the success of what is being executed. Like, you look at the Chiefs, obviously that's not an Eric Bieniemy joint. That's Andy Reid. That's the level of talent that they have on that side of the ball with Mahomes and with Kelsey and with Tyreek Hill. Bieniemy's not responsible for the success of that. I would say the same thing right here with Kevin O'Connell with the Rams. He's not responsible for the success of the L.A. Rams offense with McVay.
It's the same way I warned every single Cowboys fan when they got giddy about Mike McCarthy. Yep. I go, hate to break it to you, he didn't call plays, Rodgers did. And when he tried to, Rodgers overruled him. And when he got his plays called, they sucked, and Rodgers' body language showed you they were ridiculously bad. And that's before we even get to time management. I tried to warn Cowboys fans, he ain't the guy.
We were talking pre-show a little bit today, like, would you fire Mike McCarthy? And I know your answer to this is yes. I would say yes, too. I'd fire Mike McCarthy today, too. And it's not so much what happened in that game. Like, that might have been the straw that breaks the camel's back.
The body of work.
Just look at the whole season, complaining about officials. I don't think he's squeezed the most results out of what is a very talented roster.
And I know you're the complaint about officials point. Mine is, he showed you what he was from a game management standpoint. Over and up. What is this ozone? Right? Besides the layer that's deteriorating in the world that we live in, he's talking about the red zone and then there's the ozone. And when they're in the ozone, things are different. What? Shut up, okay? And then you let 27 seconds go off the clock because you'd rather have a field goal when you have a timeout to take and you're in the red zone to possibly get a touchdown out of it. And you go, no, you know what? We're good. We'll just take the field goal. I mean, over and over throughout the season, there was example after example after example of his clock management screw-ups, of his game decisions that were screw-ups. And it was like, you know what? Everybody kept saying, but you know what? It wasn't a playoff game. It wasn't when it really mattered. They'll be fine. Will they? Because guess what? Your season ended because of it.
Yeah. One of the pushbacks that I would have with that, though, is like, I don't think that Caserio is looking for a coordinator. I mean, look at all of the interviews that he's had. Gerard Mayo, or we expect him to interview. He's not a coordinator. Hines Ward is a receivers coach. Brian Flores was never a coordinator. Vince Lombardi's grandson, Joe, coordinator by title alone, but he's under Brandon Staley. Like, all these dudes aren't coordinators. I don't necessarily think you need to hire a coordinator to be the head coach. Two very different jobs. Like, Caserio very clearly wants a leader. He wants somebody that's going to command the respect of that locker room. And I think that the early indicators of the five interview candidates that he's going to have shows us a little bit of that.
Well, the other thing that kills me about Lombardi is he was the quarterback coach for Drew Brees. Did he really need one?
At that time, point, no.
Yeah, I don't think that Drew Brees needed a quarterback coach.
No, not at that time. 713-780-ESPN. What's your takeaway of these early candidates for the Houston Texans head coaching job? 713-780-3776. When Mel Kiper speaks, you listen. Mel Kiper today releasing his first mock draft for the 2022 NFL mock. And who even knows if we'll be drafting at number three? To quote Nick Caserio, but Evan Neal, the name for the Houston Texans, according to Mel Kiper, at number three.
The only thing I don't like is they're standing pat at number three.
Well, does he do? I know certain mock draft dudes, like, they'll do trades in their mock drafts. I'm not sure Mel Kiper does. I don't think Mel Kiper does that.
Well, I know McShay does. You're right. It's possible that he doesn't. But if you're just rating it on talent and who, based on need or otherwise, who a team would take, I'm glad that they're not taking Thibodeau. Because I heard Lance again this morning. I've heard several other people. I don't like his comments about, you know, and this was Rashawn Gary when he came out of Michigan too, talking about his brand, talking about his marketing, talking about being going to Oregon because of the association with Nike instead of worrying about, you know, where he's going to play and get the most exposure and, you know, get prepared enough for the NFL. He worries me in a guy that has to get his priorities straight. And some other things that is like, you know what? I think that he's raw. I think that he's not ready for prime time anyway. And also, as we talked about, you have so many holes to fill. None of those guys at the top of the draft are guys that you should be worried about having to have and saying there's nobody else for us. So I like getting offensive line help. I don't like it at number three. I would hope that they could do something similar by moving down.
Well, you talked about Thibodeau, and it sounds like you're not a fan of Thibodeau at all.
I'm not.
Now, Mel Kiper has him going number two in his mock. So it's not like the Texans ever even necessarily had that decision in Mel Kiper's opinion. You know what I mean?
Well, but I also don't like the fact that he's going at Alabama and trying to say that he got a better education at Oregon, but then he uses the wrong words when he's describing, trying to eloquently describe the difference between the two and gets into a back and forth with Greg McElroy about Alabama versus Oregon. And it's like, you know what you should be concerned about right now? Getting ready, working out, being ready to be the best NFL player you can be. But I think from the Texans draft perspective, the main thing that you and I both have been on the same page with since day one is you just need as many assets as possible. And no matter what you could get at number three, you could get someone that's the best player at their position group somewhere down the line. And as we get closer to the draft and it starts to really shake out what teams are worried about having to get, you know, even from the quarterback perspective, right now, Kiper's draft doesn't have a quarterback in the top 10. But if there becomes that hot commodity that's kind of skyrocketing up the draft boards like Baker Mayfield did a few years ago, and suddenly teams are fighting because they got to move up, then maybe someone's willing to take a flyer all the way up to number three. And even if it's not like your return pick isn't a top 10, but you get multiple picks in return, it's something you got to consider.
I think his first quarterback that he had being taken was Malik Willis, who I'm not a fan of Malik Willis at all. But yeah, if you're in the Texans position, you're rooting for somebody to fall in love with a quarterback that would trade up to the number three spot. And it sounds from like your perspective on your anti-Thibodeau stance, like if you had that stance, you should want Thibodeau to go first or second. That way you just get him off the board. That way you don't have that decision.
And I just assume that it's going to happen that way.
I mean, right now he's projected to go number two. The Evan Neal thing, like, I like Evan Neal as a player. The problem with that is, and like, I guess if you're drafting Evan Neal, more than likely you're going to be trading Laremy Tunsil. Now, you could just put Laremy Tunsil left tackle, Evan Neal at right tackle, and I know the dead cap situation.
No, but the funny thing that was that, because we keep talking about what Caserio said in the last couple of days on the highway to hell.
Yeah.
One of the things he did say, or basically by not saying enough, was it sounds like he's ready to move on from Tunsil.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of alluded to that, but he was kind of like,
I really do.
The problem that I don't have a problem trading Laremy Tunsil. The problem that I would have, though, is if you trade Laremy Tunsil, let's say for like a late first, I think the more realistic trade offer would be an early second rounder, is now you're using your number three pick to fill the position you just traded that player away for. So, like, it's a player who's a top five at his position, kind of like DeAndre Hopkins was.
Is he still?
And then you're, I mean, we don't know. He didn't play this year, but yeah, he's certainly capable of being a top five player, and he's still very young.
Part of the equation is a lot of people seem to believe he dogged it coming back from the injury because he didn't want to play for a bad team. And this is what you saw, you know, you gave up the farm for. I think that I get what they're saying from that perspective, but it kind of goes to what I was saying all along with by the time the rest of your team catches up to where his reputation says he currently is, he won't be what he is now. So you're better suited to get a young guy that develops into that next left tackle. And maybe he helps it like Cincinnati. Cincinnati would love to avoid giving up any more draft picks and improve their offensive line for Burrow and Chase and Mixon. You could go out and make a trade with Cincinnati. You're not going to get the haul that you gave up to get him, per se, but you're giving him to a team that desperately needs him that maybe gives you enough in return that you go, okay, I got that money off my books, and I got some young players.
It's not a like Laremy Tunsil, should you trade him conversation, because I'm totally fine trading a Laremy Tunsil. The problem that I have is if you're trading your standout franchise left tackle for an early second rounder or middle second rounder, and then you use the number three pick on another franchise left tackle. And looking at the draft, too, for Kiper, like, I look more at big boards than mock drafts. Like, the drop-off from, like, the number three overall talent to, like, the number 12 overall talent in this draft is not that great. And I would love a trade down to, like, number 12, and then you try to, like, get a secondary first-round pick, or even it's a first-round pick in 2023. I know that doesn't do anything for, like, the right now, but you and I are saying be patient in the rebuild. You're probably going to suck and maybe even need to suck for one more year. Like, if you have to kick a future, like, if you get a future first rounder in 2023 by trading down from 3 to 13, I'm all aboard for that.
We can continue this because the other thing that you have to consider is you're not only worried about your pick anyway. So you say that you're picking number 3 now, we want him to trade down. But assuming that there's a situation at a certain point when you have to do something with Deshaun, you should probably have an opportunity to get more picks anyway so you can do what you need to do. And if it's a position group like that where there's not a lot of difference between the top 2 or 3 and maybe the top 12, you'll still be able to get yourself some offensive linemen.
Let's carry this over on the other side. I got some text, too. Curious our opinion. 713-780-ESPN. If you want to get in, call to text HRMP listener line. Also, when we return, Brendan had a shower incident this morning. We'll tell you what happened. That's next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Some people call me the space cowboy.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Space cowboy. They have to play this like in the middle of the eighth inning. Like, you know,
I think
how
when they take the field, you have to play.
Maybe. You know how Fenway plays Sweet Carolina? Yeah. I think they do it in the middle of the eighth, right?
Seven.
Is it the middle of the... No, it can't be the middle of seven. That's the
well,
stretch.
It could be like... Yeah, but
I think it's the middle of the eighth, or maybe after the eighth.
I think, like, we do the Stars at night deep in the heart of Texas after the seventh inning stretch. I think that they do the same thing, only their follow-up song is Sweet Carolina, I think.
They say they do it during the eighth inning. So I think it's middle of the eighth inning that they play Sweet Carolina.
Does this mean the mascot's name has to be Maurice?
Yeah, I think it does. Go, sweet woo. They have to play that in the middle of the eighth, and they have to name it Maurice. Yeah. Absolutely. I think they should hire us with ideas about the Space Cowboys. Sugarland Skeeters changing their name to the Space Cowboys. I love it. Joel hates it. Earlier we
I
were
do
playing.
Hate it. Doesn't roll off the tongue.
We played a not very popular Steve Miller song called Space Cowboy, and people just roasted us. That's not Steve Miller. Joel was one of them. It was Steve Miller, but it's just a song that no one's ever heard of. This is the more popular reference of Space Cowboy in a Steve Miller band. We also had a nickname draft, minor league nickname draft, a little bit earlier in the show. You can head over to ESPN 97.5 to weigh in on who had the best draft. Joel took Quad City River Bandits, Chattanooga Lookouts, Lehigh Valley. What was it? I can't remember who the name was. Ooh. The Lehigh Valley,
Iron Pigs.
Iron Pigs, that's right. Brendan took the Rocket City Trash Pandas, the Binghamton Rumble Ponies, and the Montgomery Biscuits, and I took the Lansing Luck Nuts, Modesto Nuts. I didn't realize it was going with such a nut theme there, and the Omaha Storm Chasers. You can head over to ESPN 97.5 on Twitter to weigh in on who you think won the whole darn thing. We were talking about Mel Kiper's mock draft that had Evan Neal going number 3 to the Houston Texans, and like, if you're drafting Evan Neal, you're more than likely trading Laramie Tunsil. There is the possibility you play Neal at right tackle for a year or two until you eventually move on from Laramie Tunsil. But I think if you draft Evan Neal, Laramie Tunsil's out of here. A lot of texters, 713-780-3776, saying that Mel Kiper is terrible at his job. He never gets mock drafts right. They pointed out all the mistakes that he made in last year's draft and that it's a waste of time listening to him. I generally, like, I look at mock drafts to get an idea and a feel of how, like, a draft can go. But I also like to look at big boards. Like, okay, what's your top 100 big board? What's your top 20 big board? And give you a realistic idea of, like, what's best available for, like, the 18th pick of the draft. I think Lance does a great job with that sort of stuff. I'm more of a big board guy than a mock draft, but I still think it's valuable to look at and, like, at least have an idea of a scenario of how the draft could play out. Not that Kiper's right, but he's always, like, in the ballpark at least.
Yeah, look, I think the key thing as I've kind of added my two cents when we have these discussions as it relates to the Texans in the draft is you have so many position groups that need help, basically almost every single one of them. So with that in mind, you can't be too particular and you can't be too focused on just one guy. You have to be multiple position groups. And I think your goal, if you're Nick Caserio, should be take a majority of those and say, if I can end up with a player in the top 3 to the top 5 at the big board, on the big boards and our own big board in evaluation of talent, then I'm doing something to upgrade my roster.
Yeah.
Because I've got to upgrade my entire roster. Asset, that's obvious.
Asset, what did he call it? He called it, I can't remember the word that he used, but basically you're collecting assets, trying to, asset allocation, well, that was the word that he used, trying to get as many good players in here. I think we need to be very honest on what a Laremy Tunsil trade would look like. We had a texter saying a first and a second would be a good haul for Laremy Tunsil. If you get a late first-round draft pick right now for Laremy Tunsil, you did something incredibly right. Like I think the realistic trade right now for Laremy Tunsil is going to be an early second-round draft pick, maybe even a middle second-round draft pick, or like a second and a third, something like
that. That low, huh?
Yeah. I wouldn't be shocked to see a late first. Late first to me is the total upside.
I think it's a future first.
If it's the range, I think it's a late first to a middle second.
I think it's a future first. And I think like the scenario that I painted with Cincinnati.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think it would also be one from a playoff team because it's someone that needs him immediately that probably is going to be a decent team. So it's kind of like the Harden Nets deal, but on a smaller scale where you go, look, what I'm trying to get is a first round pick, but you can't put parameters on it because the team's willing to give you as high as a first round pick for him. It's essentially going to be a glamorized second round pick because it's going to be late in the first round.
The secondary point to trading for Laremy Tunsil as well is the fact that you're going to have to pay him again. Remember whenever he signed his contract, he signed it like a short-term deal, not the big long-term deal. Like, it expires after 2023. He has a potential out after the 2023 season.
And he's gone. And if he gets to that point, he's leaving.
Yeah, and if you're going to trade for him, that means you're going to sign him to a big contract extension that's going to be in the top five of left tackle money. So at that point, that diminishes his value because you're going to have to pay him so much money to lock him up long-term that, like, Cincinnati to me is a good example, but that's the high-end potential of what you could get in return for a Laremy Tunsil. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776.
Can I also point out for you Texans fans, when you have any kind of sympathy, which you shouldn't have, for Bill O'Brien or anybody in the Texans organization that did what they did in regards to Tunsil and Jack Easterby. And he's more than shade, in my opinion. He's still the black cloud. But as we talked about earlier in the show, if you missed it, go to the podcast. Here's the thing. When you talk about what they did and their lack of foresight to get an extension done before the trade was executed, and you left him dangle out there, when he went into the negotiations and he knew how bad he had you, he did not have an agent. Let me repeat that. He did not have an agent. And when Jeremy's talking about big boards in terms of how he rated and what he got financially, he didn't just become the number one highest paid player as a left tackle in the NFL. He became it by a significant number, by $6 to $7 million, and he did not have an agent. That's how bad they were over a barrel. That's how much they got used by a guy in a situation they didn't have to be in if they were just smart enough to get the extension done before the trade was executed.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the past versus the present, and like it's difficult. I mean, if you're having the conversation about the Texans, the past is very much a part of the story because the past has led you to where you are now. That was a different regime. That was the failure of a Bill O'Brien. That was the failure of a Jack Easterby. I know Easterby's still in the organization. I don't believe he has anything to do with the 53. And I think whenever we have this conversation as well, that like you mentioned that like what you gave up to Laremy Tunsil in terms of the package that you sent to Miami, which was way too much. The contract that you then had to sign him after, like later on, not even at the time of the trade, people are going to see that and look at that as like the baseline of what the Texans need to get in return. You're going to get nowhere near that. Like 6183 saying, is Tunsil not a top 10 tackle in the league? Yes, he is. And he said a second round pick after you gave up two number ones to get him. That's how bad of a trade it was for Bill O'Brien. Fast forward to where Laremy Tunsil's at now, where he didn't play for a majority of the season after a thumb injury, where he should have been back, you know, certainly at some point in the season, didn't come back. So you don't necessarily have the film and other teams don't have the tape on what he was post-injury. Not that it was a severe injury or anything like that. But then you throw on top of that the contract extension you would have to give Laremy Tunsil if you trade for him. No one in the top 15 is going to be trading for a Laremy Tunsil. It'd be at best a late first round or early second.
It's a fact. It's a fact. And that's, again, when you want – Texans fans, we love the passion you bring when you're looking at all these different situations, but you got to be realistic. And being realistic in this case is, and again, this is, goes back to a conversation you and I had months ago when I was talking about how passionate the Texans are and the reason why they might not pull the trigger on a Tunsil deal is because they're worried about the backlash they would get for so many fans and so many people pointing to the finger and going, you didn't even get back a fraction of what you gave up to get this guy. How stupid are you? They don't like that. But they're going to have to face the harsh reality, which is his value right now isn't what it was back then when you made the trade. And maybe you inflated it more than it had to be. But realistically, from the cap number that he brings and how much of the cap he's consuming when he's not worth it with the roster that you have, and the fact, like you said, his contract's coming up yet again, and you still have – he's one of the remaining few guys on your roster that has value in a trade. The time is now to pull the plug, cut bait, save money, get whatever you can for him in a yard sale, and just move on, because you're not at a point where you need one of the 10 best left tackles in the game.
Yeah, this text is a good point, too. Caserio isn't a stupid man, maybe a shyster, but not stupid. Playing Tunsil during the final 10 games of that season would have been stupid. I agree with that. And you could even, like, if you want to have the conversation, too, about what the return's going to be for Laremy Tunsil, if the at best you get is a middle second rounder, does it make more sense just keeping Laremy Tunsil? Like, to me, that conversation's a fair one. I wouldn't have played him either.
The bigger, it's the principle of the matter that he didn't want to play.
Yeah.
The fact that you're looking for someone that cares about the game of football, that wants to play the game of football, that wants to earn the money that you gave him and come up on your side of the deal to earn it for what they did on their side of the deal to take care of you. And the fact that he just kept hemming and hawing because he didn't want to play. Let the organization make that decision, but come to work ready to play.
Yeah. We'll get into Brandon Schauer controversy at 2:15. But coming up next, Carlos Correa hired Scott Boras as his new agent. Does that matter? Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, right now I want to tell you about the good people at Apollo Men's Health. I tell you about them all the time, and I tell you about them for a reason, because they get results. They do what they say they're going to do, and they've done it for me. They can do it for you, too. They can do it for men and women when it comes to hormone therapy. If you don't have energy like you once had in your life and you want to change that, you think that that's impossible. I can't get the feel like the way I used to. Yes, you can. But it's all you got to do is set up the first appointment. There are men and women in the lobby every single time I'm in there or we're doing a remote from there, and they're getting results. That's why they're coming back, and you can be the next in line. Go to ApolloMH.com. You're going to find out all the different services they offer and how they can help you. But they have a solution for everything you got going on in your life where it's not living up to what you used to do. From the boardroom to the weight room to the bedroom. Your health is your wealth. You invest in yourself. It's a new year. It can be a new you too. But it starts with you making that first initial contact. They are experts in their field. They're going to take care of you every step of the way. You're going to find out most major insurance is accepted and there's discounts for military personnel and first responders. But more so, you're going to find out they are experts. They worked at those other places that try and give you everything under the sun, and they've limited it to just the things that work, that get results. If you want to get on a workout program, they can set you up with a full body composition analysis, and then periodically you can check in, do another analysis, and chart your progress. You want to recover quicker? HGH peptide therapy. You want vitamins and things for your smoothies and fat burners? They got those too. They take care of you every single day, and you got to be the next in line to do what I do. Go in there, and by the way, mention my name in ESPN 97.5. You're going to get a free B12 shot on your first visit. But Dr. O has made me a believer, and he's taken care of me, and I've seen the improvements. I've seen the results, and you can too. Check him out today. It's ApolloMH.com, the good people at Apollo Men's Health.
Talking sports with you, not at you. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Carlos Correa has hired Scott Boras as his agent. Whenever you saw that, what did you think?
I have a large level of disdain for Scott Boras because of going back to the Beltran deal where he left the Drayton and the Astros on the altar. Mm-hmm. To the fact that he is just a money-grubbing, every single penny he can get type guy. And then I start thinking about the one way it actually could make sense for the Astros that helps them is, but it screwed him. He screwed Dallas Keuchel because he gave him a false sense of what he could get out on the open market, and Keuchel had to settle for a one-year deal at the end of it.
That's an interesting opinion on that.
I'm just thinking about Astros-related deals that he's been involved in. And he is the one thing that we know for sure, and I remember how arrogant he was when he sat behind home plate throughout the years, too, about the fact that, look, you know what? I love that my players love where they're playing, but essentially his mindset is, but I'm getting every single penny that I can get for them, and it is part of that for me.
713-780-3776. Houston, what did you think when you saw Carlos Correa hired Scott Boras as his agent? When I saw that, it didn't change my opinion on Carlos Correa being back or leaving the Houston Astros at all. Scott Boras is not anti-Astro. He's pro-money. But we already knew that Carlos Correa was going to demand a lot of money. Like, the fact that Scott Boras is now his agent doesn't change, like, Carlos Correa's demands whatsoever. If the Astros still meet the demands of one Carlos Correa, they can still sign Carlos Correa despite Scott Boras being his agent. The takeaway that I had of this wasn't that Carlos Correa's days are done with the Houston Astros.
No.
And to be fair, we've thought that Carlos Correa's days with the Houston Astros have been done a long time ago, and I think we've been injecting the city with truth serum about that for sure. What this showed me, my biggest takeaway of this with Correa signing with Scott Boras, is that he wasn't getting the offers that he thought he was going to get.
Yeah, that's what I was going to follow up with next. I think that the underlying message, other than getting a savvy business guy, was that he's pretty ticked off that Seager got more money than a lot of people thought he was going to get, and that's a bad look for a guy that's still out there that hasn't got the offer that he wanted to get, and that maybe, just maybe, his agent in his mind wasn't doing nearly what other guys were to get the money that they got.
That was my biggest sense, was that Carlos Correa, you know who hires new agents in the middle of the offseason, even if there's a lockout? Dudes that are not happy with the contract offers that they're getting. It has nothing to do with Carlos Correa wants to go away from the Houston Astros and that he's doing that for Scott Boras. It shows you that he wasn't happy with the offers that he was getting. Now, Scott Boras actually has, and in all the examples that you brought up of like why Boras doesn't have a great relationship with the Astros, I thought he had a pretty good relationship with Luno, though. Like, He's had some extensions with the Houston Astros that are actually pro Houston Astros.
Well, I think you got to go into it with the open mind of it's a business, right? You can't hate this guy personally or think it's something that you can't go into a negotiation like from a Luno perspective. I think he was able to kind of separate Scott Boras the individual and Scott Boras the businessman and realized, hey, this wasn't about his hate of the Astros. This was about, again, getting every single dollar he could for his client.
And that's the way Scott Boras operates, and that's what a good agent does, right? You maximize the dollar that you can get. That's why he's hired by a lot of different baseball players. Would it surprise you that Scott Boras has three Houston Astros as clients right now? And two of them have signed an extension with the Houston Astros with Scott Boras as their client.
If you ask me to guess, I don't know that I could. I mean, are they pretty top of the line players?
Uh-huh. So Alex Bregman's one of them.
I thought Bregman might be.
To be fair, his extension was before Scott Boras. Because remember, the Astros signed him pre-arbitration. They took away a couple of his free agent
years.
Tried
to do him a solid.
Astros got the solid there.
But the optics.
They gave him money up front.
The optics on the external was to send a message, we're not going to do what we did to Springer. And so we're going to try and take care of you a little bit.
Well,
I think that
was the Springer offer, basically.
But I think because there was the reputation out there that they were hyper cheap and that they were going to do whatever was necessary to hold the player down just so that they could save money, that whether it was the ultimate takeaway from everybody or not, I think Luno tried to send the message that, hey, look, that was then, this is now. We don't have to do a deal for Bregman right now, but we're going to.
My opinion of that was Luno was trying to screw over the player on both fronts. He gave George Springer the option of, here's a big contract, and if you sign it, you can be in the big leagues right now, and if you don't, we're going to manipulate your service time and keep you for another year or two. He did the same thing with Alex Bregman after he was up by signing him to a team-friendly contract that took away the formidable years of Alex Bregman's free agency. But that was pre-Boras. And you can make the case that Alex Bregman, who was unhappy with his contract, that's why he went with Scott Boras, that can negotiate eventually his second contract. The two Astros that are significant with Scott Boras and that have signed extensions with the Astros being under Scott Boras, the latest one was Lance McCullers. Lance McCullers signed with the Houston Astros
was a pretty affordable deal.
Yep. So, you know, you look at Scott Boras a little bit differently when it's like, oh, he was the agent of Lance McCullers, who team-friendly deal. Like, he's going to do what his client tells him to do. So that was pro-Houston Astros. And the other Scott Boras clients, Jose Altuve. Now, Scott Boras was not the agent of Jose Altuve when he signed that first deal, which was the sweetheart deal and the best contract in all of sports whenever he was winning MVPs and making like $7 million a year. Altuve went to Boras for his second deal, and the Astros, I mean, Altuve's second contract's pretty big, too, but the Astros wanted to take care of their star. But you look at those, especially the two players, Jose Altuve, Lance McCullers, the fact that Correa signed with Scott Boras does not, like, eliminate the 5% chance I put it at that Carlos Correa is going to be back with the Houston Astros. To me, the biggest tell here is that Carlos Correa was not getting the offers that he wanted in free agency. Boras is the agent of Corey Seager, who got the $325 million deal for 10 years. John Heyman tweeted out earlier today that Carlos Correa's position before the lockout was that he wanted $330 million to $350 million, but $330 was the clear minimum ask. Like, if that was the number at the beginning, I don't care who your agent was. The Astros weren't paying that. This doesn't change a darn thing.
No, it doesn't change except for the fact that he said if you can't beat him, join him. And because he wasn't getting offers that was beating Seager's, yep, he got the guy that got him the deal that was beating any offer that he had received. Smart business move on his fat part. Now he's going to have to make a tough decision at a certain point, because a lot of times when you're putting parameters like that out there and you're putting the minimums out there, most of the teams that are going to offer you that kind of money aren't going to be the kind of team that you want to play for. So you better suck it up, Buttercup, and realize it's one or the other. It's a really, really good team with less than that for money to offer you and less years, or it's a really, really bad team that's looking for you to be the savior. And then you damn well better stay healthy, and you better be able to put multiple seasons like last year on the table again and again and again. And I'm not sure he's capable of that.
I wouldn't re-sign him for the money that he wants. We've talked about this a lot before the lockout. Like, a lot of fans have the idea of pay the guy for what he's done, when a GM's job is to try to figure out the value for a guy and what he's going to do. And even if you take what Carlos Correa has done in the previous 7 years of his big league career, that doesn't demand a $330 million contract. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. 5506 heard us talk about that Bregman contract, which at the time was a sweetheart deal for the Houston Astros. Yeah. And he brings up the question, do you think Bregman has outplayed that contract? I don't think so. 2021, he made $11 million. Like, he was hurt all year long. Did he give you $11 million of value? Probably not. Next year, he makes 11. 23, he makes 28.5. 24, he makes 28.5.
At 11, he's worth every penny no matter what he gives you because of all the intangibles and everything, and the variables that you can't control, like injuries. And he just had one of those years last year. But overall, to make sure that he stays here and what he means for the city, for the fan base, for the locker room, and then what he provides defensively, offensively, and otherwise, and the fact that his track record's been pretty good, I think until you get to those $20 million a year years, I think, yeah, he's fine.
Yeah, one of the other reasons Tyler Scott, our APD, just texted us into, saying that one of the other reasons is that Correa's current agent, the MLBPA, was pressuring Endeavor agents to divest from the company. So there was a little bit of shadiness going on with his agency. MLBPA was saying, get away from those guys. And if you're going to change agents, why not go to the very best, right? And Scott Boras. Carlos Correa. As far as Bregman's concern is, like, in terms of, like, has he played up to the money? Maybe not. But if he hit the open market, he would have made far more than the current contract that he's on. So, yeah, that's a win whenever
you
look at that.
That's the best point you can make, because that's right. Because otherwise, if you could get Alex Bregman for $11 million a year across Major League Baseball, there's not a contender in the league that would, on both sides in either league, that wouldn't sign up today and go, give me him now.
Well, it does spike up in 23 and 24 to 28.5.
I get that.
So you want him to improve.
And you hope he's healthy. If he's healthy by then, and you know he's focused, he's constantly in the cages working on his game. It's not like he's not, you know, we were just talking about guys that aren't dialed into football. Like, they're worried about other things first. You don't have to worry about that with Alex Bregman.
He is. He likes to broadcast it, though.
That's part of who he is. That why the fans love him, because, you know, it's like it's like that thing that I used to say about, you know, Matt Harpering or Patrick Beverly. You know, you're not going to get Christmas cards from every other team in the league, but when he's on your team, you love the hell out of him, and you'll give him all the Christmas cards he needs because of the fact that he brings that little, that intangible, that FU, that toughness, that that bravado that Houston fans just are drawn to.
Yeah, I mean, I like Bregman. I don't want to make it sound like I don't.
713. You don't like his salsa.
I don't like his salsa. That's a fact. I give it a 2.5 or a 3 on a scale of 10. Brendan had his thumb up. Have you had it? Are you saying that it's good salsa? Like, certainly you don't think that. I know you're from Detroit.
Thought it was a good comment.
Salsa from New York City. I mean, you're from Michigan. You wouldn't know anything about salsa.
You got
salsa.
The pace?
713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. So I think the Houston Texans coaching staff is set. Hear me out. I'll tell you why when we return. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.